to order.
The order I would like to begin with this on page 169, the
okay.
beginning of the section into the third and last category. And then, do you want to, Jeffrey, to take
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'll go
then,
for it, yeah.
For the 16?
And then
ah, no,
and then...
no. May I propose the opposite? Because the last time, John Robert read paragraph 17, so this time, he can begin with the 16. So this object of the integral yoga on page.
Okay. So John Robert and then me.
No, me, Marco, John Robert, and then Geoffrey.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
So we avoid reading the same
and
thing.
If Andrea comes, she comes in after me. So
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Okay.
A few minutes.
So I've got the bell here.
Yeah. So I recall Ora, me, John Robert, and Geoffrey. Into the third and last category of the works of sacrifice can be gathered all that is directly proper to the yoga of works. For here is its direct field of effectuation and major province. It covers the entire range of life's more visible activities. Under it fall the multiform energies of the will to life, throwing itself outward to make the most of material existence. It is here that an ascetic or otherworldly spirituality feels an insurmountable denial of the truth, which it seeks after and is compelled to turn away from terrestrial existence, rejecting it as forever the dark playground of an incurable ignorance. Yet it is precisely these activities that are claimed for a spiritual conquest and divine transformation by the integral yoga. Abandoned altogether by the more ascetic disciplines, accepted by others only as a field of temporary ordeal or a momentary superficial and ambiguous play of the concealed spirit, this existence is fully embraced and welcomed by the integral seeker as a field of fulfillment, a field for divine works, a field for the total self-discovery of the concealed and indwelling spirit. A discovery of the divinity in oneself is his first object, but a total discovery too of the divinity in the world behind the apparent denial offered by its seem and figures, and last, a total discovery of the dynamism of some transcendent eternal, for by its descent, this world and self will be empowered to break their disguising envelopes and become divine in revealing form and manifesting process as they now are secretly in their hidden essence.
This object of the integral yoga must be accepted wholly by those who follow it. But the acceptance must not be in ignorance of the immense stumbling blocks that lie in the way of the achievement. On the contrary, we must be fully aware of the compelling cause of the refusal of so many other disciplines to regard even its possibility, much less its imperative character, as the true meaning of terrestrial existence. For here in the works of life, in the earth nature, is the very heart of the difficulty that has driven philosophy to its heights of aloofness and turned away even the eager eye of religion from the malady of birth in a mortal body to a distant paradise or a silent peace of nirvana. A way of pure knowledge is comparatively straightforward and easy to tread of the seeker in spite of our mental limitations and the pitfalls of the ignorance. A way of pure love, although it has its stumbling blocks and its sufferings and trials, can, in comparison, be as easy as the wing of a bird through the free azure. For knowledge and love are pure in their essence and become mixed and embarrassed, corrupted and degraded, only when they enter into the ambiguous movement of the life forces and are seized by them for the outward life's crude movements and obstinately inferior motives. Alone of the three powers, life, or at least a certain predominant will in life, has the appearance of something impure, accursed, or fallen in its very essence. At its contact, wrapped in its dull sheaths or caught in its iridescent quagmires, the divinities themselves become common and muddy, and hardly escape from being dragged downward into its perversions and disastrously assimilated to the demon and the asura. A principle of dark, dull inertia is at its base. All are tied down by the body and its needs and desires to a trivial mind, petty desires and emotions, an insignificant repetition of small, worthless functionings, needs, cares, occupations, pains, pleasures that lead to nothing beyond themselves and bear the stamp of an ignorance that knows not its own why and whither. This physical mind of inertia believes in no divinity other than its own small earth gods. It aspires perhaps to a greater comfort, order, pleasure, but asks for no uplifting and no spiritual deliverance. At the center, we meet a stronger will of life with a greater gusto, but it is a blinded daemon, a perverted spirit, and exults in the very elements that make of life a striving turmoil and an unhappy imbroglio. It is a soul of human or titanic desire, clinging to the garish color, disordered poetry, violent tragedy, or stirring melodrama of this mixed flux of good and evil, joy and sorrow, light and darkness, the heady rapture and bitter torture. It loves these things and would have more and more of them, or even when it suffers and cries out against them, can accept or joy in nothing else. It hates and revolts against higher things, and in its fury would trample, tear, or crucify any diviner power that has the presumption to offer to make life pure, luminous, and happy, and snatch from its lips the fiery brew of that exciting mixture. Another will in life there is that is ready to follow the ameliorating ideal mind and is allured by its offer to extract some harmony, beauty, light, nobler order out of life. But this is a smaller part of the vital nature and can be easily overpowered by its more violent or darker, duller yoke comrades. Nor does it readily lend itself to a call higher than that of the mind, unless that call defeats itself, as religion usually does, by lowering its demand to conditions more intelligible to our obscure vital nature. All these forces the spiritual seeker grows aware of in himself and finds all around him, and has to struggle and combat incessantly to be rid of their grip and dislodge the long-trenched mastery they have exercised over his being, as over the environing human existence. The difficulty is great, for their hold is so strong, so apparently invincible, that it justifies the disdainful dictum which compares human nature to a dog's tail. For straighten it never so much by force of ethics, religion, reason, or any other redemptive effort, it returns in the end always to the crooked curl of nature. And so great is the vim, the clutch of that more agitated life will, so immense the peril of its passions and errors, so subtly insistent or persistently invasive, so obstinate up to the very gates of heaven, the fury of its attack, or the tedious obstruction of its obstacles, that even the saint and the yogin cannot be sure of their liberated purity or their trained self-mastery against its intrigue or its violence. All labor to straighten out this native crookedness strikes the struggling will as a futility, a flight, a withdrawal to happy heaven or peaceful dissolution easily finds credit as the only wisdom, and to find a way not to be born again gets established as the only remedy for the dull bondage or the poor, shoddy delirium or the blinded and precarious happiness and achievement of earthly existence.
So, Andrea, we're in the middle of page 172.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have your pages. So we are in chapter, The Ascent of the Sacrifice?
Yes.
Yes.
And we're about two-thirds the way through. I think we're backed up to where you were last time.
You started back?
Yes, went back to the beginning of the section. And okay. Started the section over.
So from the beginning of the section, does somebody have the count of paragraphs? That would help me, because I don't have pages.
We're 17. Paragraph 3 after the break of section.
After the beginning of the chapter?
After the break of section.
So there's a break of
section about two-thirds of the way through. And we're on paragraph 3 after the break.
So there's a section that begins into the third and last category?
Yes.
And then then which paragraph?
The paragraph I'm about to start is a remedy yet there should be.
Okay, gotcha.
And you'll follow me.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. I was just in the very same place that I heard you read about. It's like, oh my God, poor man. So I'm glad to be here. Thank you. Go ahead.
A remedy yet there should be and is a way of redress and a chance of transformation for this troubled vital nature. But for that, the cause of deviation must be found and remedied at the heart of life itself and in its very principles, since life too is a power of the divine and not a creation of some malignant chance or dark titanic impulse, however obscure and perverted may be its actual appearance. In life itself, there is the seed of its own salvation. It is from the life energy that we must get our leverage. For though there is a saving light in knowledge, a redeeming and transforming force in love, these cannot be effective here unless they secure the consent of life and can use the instrumentation of some delivered energy at its center for a sublimation of the erring human into a divine life force. It is not possible to cut the difficulty by a splitting up of the works of sacrifice. We cannot escape it by deciding that we shall do only the works of love and knowledge and leave aside the works of will and power, possession and acquisition, production and fruitful expense of capacity, battle and victory and mastery, striking away from us the larger part of life, because it seems to be made of the very stuff of desire and ego, and therefore doomed to be a field of disharmony and mere conflict and disorder. For the division cannot really be made, or if attempted, it must fail in its essential purpose, since it would isolate us from the total energies of the world power and sterilize an important part of integral nature, just the one force in it that is a necessary instrument of any world creative purpose. The life force is an indispensable intermediary, the effectuating element in nature here. Mind needs its alliance if the works of mind are not to remain shining inner formations without a body. The spirit needs it to give an outer force and form to its manifested possibilities and arrive at a complete self-expression incarnated in matter. If life refuses the aid of its intermediary energy to the spirit's other workings, or is itself refused, they are likely to be reduced for all the effect they can have here to a static seclusion or a golden impotence. And if anything is done, it will be a partial irradiation of our action, more subjective than objective, modifying existence perhaps, but without force to change it. Yet if life brings its forces to the spirit, but unregenerate, a worse result may follow, since it is likely to reduce the spiritual action of love or knowledge to diminished and corrupted motions, or make them accomplishes of its own inferior or perverse workings. Life is indispensable to the completeness of the creative spiritual realization, but life released, transformed, uplifted, not the ordinarily mentalized human animal life, nor the demoniac or titanic, nor even the divine and the undivine mixed together. Whatever may be done by other world shunning or heaven seeking disciplines, this is the difficult but unavoidable task of the integral yoga. It cannot afford to leave unsolved the problem of the outward works of life. It must find in them their native divinity and ally it firmly and forever to the divinities of love and knowledge.
It is no solution either to postpone dealing with the works of life till love and knowledge have been evolved to a point at which they can sovereignly and with safety lay hold on the life force to regenerate it. For we have seen that they have to rise to immense heights before they can be secure from the vital perversion which hampers or hamstrings their power to deliver. If once our consciousness could reach the heights of a supramental nature, then indeed these disabilities would disappear. But here there is the dilemma that it is impossible to reach the supramental heights with the burden of an unregenerated life force on our shoulders, and equally impossible to regenerate radically the will in life without bringing down the infallible light and the unconquerable power that belong to the spiritual and supramental levels. The supramental consciousness is not only a knowledge, a bliss, an intimate love and oneness, it is also a will, a principle of power and force, and it cannot descend till the element of will, of power, of force in this manifested nature is sufficiently developed and sublimated to receive and bear it. But will, power, force are the native substance of the life energy. And herein lies the justification for the refusal of life to acknowledge the supremacy of knowledge and love alone. For its push towards the satisfaction of something far more unreflecting, headstrong and dangerous, that can yet venture too in its own bold and ardent way towards the divine and absolute. Love and wisdom are not the only aspects of the divine. There is also the aspect of power. As the mind gropes for knowledge, as the heart feels out for love, so the life force, however fumblingly or trepidantly, stumbles in search of power and the control given by power. It is a mistake of the ethical or religious mind to condemn power as in itself a thing not to be accepted or sought after, because naturally corrupting and evil. In spite of its apparent justification by a majority of instances, this is at its core a blind and irrational prejudice. However corrupted and misused, as love and knowledge too are corrupted and misused, power is divine and put here for a divine use. Shakti, will, power, is the driver of the worlds, and whether it be knowledge force or love force or life force or action force or body force is always spiritual in its origin and divine in its character. It is the use of it made in the ignorance by brute man or titan that has to be cast aside and replaced by its greater natural, even if to us supernormal, action led by an inner consciousness which is in tune with the infinite and the eternal. The integral yoga cannot reject the works of life and be satisfied with an inward experience only. It has to go inward in order to change the outward, making the life force a part and a working of a yoga energy, which is in touch with the divine and divine in its guidance.
All the difficulty in dealing spiritually with the works of life arise because the will in life for its purposes in the ignorance has created a false soul of desire and substituted it for the spark of the divine, which is the true psyche. All or most of the works of life are at present or seem to be actuated and vitiated by this soul of desire. Even those that are ethical or religious even those that wear the guise of altruism, philanthropy, self-sacrifice, self-denial, are shot through and through with the threads of its making. The soul of desire is a separative soul of ego, and all its instincts are for separative self-affirmation. It pushes always openly or under more or less shining masks for its own growth, for possession, for enjoyment, for conquest and empire. If the curse of disquiet and disharmony and perversion is to be lifted from life, the true soul, the psychic being, must be given its leading place, and there must be a dissolution of the false soul of desire and ego. But this does not mean that life itself must be coerced and denied its native line of fulfillment, for behind this outer life, soul of desire, there is in us an inner and true vital being which has not to be dissolved, but brought out into prominence and released to its true working as a power of the divine nature. The prominence of this true vital being under the lead of the true inmost soul within us is the condition for the divine fulfillment of the objects of the life force. Those objects will even remain the same in essence, but transformed in their inner motive and outer character. The divine life power, too, will be a will for growth, a force of self-affirmation, but affirmation of the divine within us, not the little temporary personality on the surface. Grows in the true and divine individual, the central being, the secret imperishable person who can emerge only by the subordination and disappearance of the ego. This is life's true object. Grows, but the growth of the spirit in nature, affirming and developing itself in mind, life, and body. Possession, but a possession by the divine of the divine in all things, and not of things for their own sake, by the desire of the ego. Enjoyment, but an enjoyment of the divine ananda in the universe. Battle and conquest and empire in the shape of victorious conflict with the powers of darkness, an entire spiritual self-rule and mastery over inward and outward nature, a conquest by knowledge, love, and divine will over the domains of the ignorance.
These are the conditions, and these must be the aims of the divine effectuation of the works of life in their progressive transformation, which is the third element of the triple sacrifice. It is not a rationalization, but a supramentalization. Not a moralizing, but a spiritualizing of life that is the object of the yoga. It is not a handling of externals or superficial psychological motives that is its main purpose, but a refounding of life and its action on their hidden divine element. For only such a refounding of life can bring about its direct government by the secret divine power above us and its transfiguration into a manifest expression of the divinity, not as now a disguise and a disfiguring mask of the eternal actor. It is a spiritual essential change of consciousness, not the surface manipulation, which is the method of mind and reason, that can alone make life other than it is now and rescue it out of its present distressed and ambiguous figure.
So there's a break there. Does somebody want to talk about what we read?
Yeah, I think this is good stuff to discuss.
Absolutely.
I think he's saying this is really kind of the heart of the difficulty of this integral yoga, which includes the whole person, not just an ascent somewhere and disappearance. Like what I was when I grew up in religion, that was the purpose that was set before us. And I think this is a really difficult part. I've just been listening to a week-long seminar of different speakers on trauma and trauma healing. And it seems to me some of these teachers are speaking about this in a different language, but actually speaking about these processes, not in the kind of superficial change that Sri Aurobindo is dismissing here. And they're connecting, in trauma terms, they're connecting personal trauma with ancestral family trauma and ancestral trauma, and as well collective trauma, social trauma, as kind of a norm that we live in, and talking about bringing the and also really focusing on the body, which is where a lot of this stuff is stored. So I'm really interested in this whole trauma work that I've been reading about for a while, and I'm interested in how someone could put these two different languages together and see what they were saying to each other.
Yeah, that's very interesting, John Robert, because I also noticed this, and I was in fact wondering if it's me, you know, you are more attentive in seeing these things with the trauma. I mean, that now that this discussion about the trauma, especially generational trauma, but every kind of trauma, has surfaced into a collective debate and consciousness, and people are discussing about this a lot. So thank you that you also brought this up, because I was just wondering, is it me who just by coincidence on the media hears speaking about these things continuously? Or so it seems that I think the collective consciousness is beginning to, how do you say, elaborate, churn also this thing. Because my impression is, Sri Aurobindo does not say this here, but my impression is that nobody of us has not some trauma of some type or another. Everyone. And I'm myself beginning to discover some now at the age of 56 years that I didn't suspect. That's quite interesting. And I simply didn't notice and didn't. And you say, but what if a trauma, how can you not notice a trauma? Yeah, you can very well ignore it, repress it, you know, your mind, your conscience, or justify it even worse. But having said that, I know, because this was a preamble to a question. I don't understand, John Robert, how do you connect this issue with the trauma with the fact that Sri Aurobindo, you know, he's very well known for this insistence that we should not retire from life and we should not ignore the life force, life will, which is the subject of these paragraphs. How do you connect this to the question of trauma?
Well, trauma is sometimes, trauma effects in us are sometimes described as dissociation or separation or fragmentation. And so the mechanism of trauma unconscious in us is to separate us from precisely what he's talking about, engaging in life. And the word fragmentation comes up over and over again in contrast with the word integration or reunion. So some of these are really basic concepts. And it's very interesting to me because only recently I began noticing the same thing that you were, that I never thought of myself as having trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder or anything like that. And I started reading some of these authors and they talked about the symptoms. And I thought, okay, I have that one. Yeah, and I had that one. Oh, I had that one. I had that one. I still have this one. I still have this one. Whoa, what's going on here? And I can't say that I know what's going on here, except something in me is really drawn to this work as a way of trying to help me through some of the kind of the internal difficulties in my body that I can't understand, when I experience them, I don't even know how to talk about them because there are no words. I don't know words for these things. I never heard words for these things. And yet it's very real. When I was meditating this morning, I was feeling all this pain in my shoulders. Well, right now I don't feel any pain in my shoulders. But when I go in and really pay attention to my body, boom, there it is. Oh, whoa, where did that come from? And it's very persistent. So I try to relax my shoulders. And when I try to relax my shoulders say to me, I don't know how to relax. I don't even know what it means. I don't even know where being relaxed would be, what position it would be. So, you know, all this discussion around it is encouraging to me to pursue this exploration that there's, and it's also encouraging that, oh, maybe this is not just me, just this little person here, but maybe it has to do going back. The discussion I was just listening to talked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Holocaust in Germany. And some of my ancestors come from Ireland. So there's so much trauma in that history. So I don't know. I mean, it's not like, oh, now I understand, but it's giving me a sense of encouragement and direction.
Yeah, thank you, Zhenrob. Now I got it. It's trauma as separation. Because also Sri Aurobindo is speaking of the separation here from life, and you connect it as a trauma. Yeah, a very interesting perspective. I never thought about that. That's food for thought. Yes, thank you.
And to work through trauma, you have to go into the body. That's where it sits in the being. So you have to do what Aurobindo says here. And also, a lot of some of the ways that people treat trauma is to get them to engage in the world, because that's another way to relieve a certain level of trauma as well. So all of that parallels what Aurobindo is talking about here.
That's why I love reading these things together, because they give me always not a different opinion, but a different perspective, which is very, very powerful, because Sri Aurobindo must be read from very different perspectives and then seen from all perspectives at once. Only then you can understand Sri Aurobindo. Yeah.
Are we ready for me to go on? Or? It is then by a transformation of life in this very principle, not by an external manipulation of its phenomena, that the integral yoga proposes to change it from a troubled and ignorant into a luminous and harmonious movement of nature. There are three conditions which are indispensable for the achievement of this central inner revolution and new formation. None of them is altogether sufficient in itself, but by their united threefold power, the uplifting can be done, the conversion made, and completely made. First, life as it is a movement of desire, and it has built in us as its desire, as its center, a desire soul, which refers to itself all the motions of life and puts in them its own troubled hue and pain of an ignorant, half-lit, baffled endeavor. For a divine living, desire must be abolished and replaced by a purer and firmer motive power. The tormented soul of desire dissolved, and in its stead, there must emerge the calm, the strength, the happiness of a true vital being now concealed within us. Next, life as it is driven or led partly by the impulse of the life force, partly by a mind which is mostly a servant and a better of the ignorant life impulse, but in part also its uneasy and not too luminous or competent guide and mentor. For divine life, the mind and the life impulse must cease to be anything but instruments, and the inmost psychic being must take their place as the leader on the path and the indicator of a divine guidance. Last, life as it is turned toward the satisfaction of the separative ego. Ego must disappear and be replaced by the true spiritual person, the central being, and life itself must be turned toward the fulfillment of the divine in terrestrial existence. It must feel a divine force awakening within it and become an obedient instrument of its purpose.
There is nothing that is not ancient and familiar in the first of these three transforming inner movements. For it has always been one of the central principal object of spiritual discipline. So the first one is the tormented soul of desire dissolved, and in its stead there must emerge a calm, strength, happiness of the true vital being. It has always been one of the principal object of spiritual discipline. It has been best formulated in the clearly expressed doctrine of the Gita, by which a complete renouncement of desire for the fruits as the motive of action, a complete annulment of desire itself, the complete achievement of a perfect equality are put forward as a normal status of a spiritual being. A perfect spiritual equality is the one true and infallible sign of the cessation of desire. To be equal soul to all things, unmoved by joy and sorrow, the pleasant and the unpleasant, success or failure. To look with an equal eye on high and low, friend and enemy, the virtuous and the sinner. To see in all beings the manifold manifestation of the One and in all things the multitudinous play or the slow massed evolution of the embodied spirit. It is not a mental quiet, aloofness, indifference, not an inert vital quiescence, not a passivity of the physical consciousness consenting to no movement or to any movement that is the condition aimed at, though these things are sometimes mistaken for this spiritual condition, but a wide, comprehensive, unmoved universality, such as that of the witness spirit behind nature. For all here seems to be immobile, half-ordered, half-confused organization of forces, but behind them one can feel a supporting peace, silence, wideness, not inert, but calm, not impotent, but potentially omnipotent, with a concentrated, stable, immobile energy in it, capable of bearing all the motions of the universe. This presence behind is equal-souled to all things. The energy it holds in it can be unloosed for any action, but no action will be chosen by any desire in the witness spirit. A truth acts which is beyond and greater than the action itself or its apparent forms and impulses, beyond and greater than mind or life force or body, although it may take for the immediate purpose a mental, a vital, or a physical appearance. It is when there is this death of desire and this calm, equal wideness in the consciousness everywhere that the true vital being within us comes out from the veil and reveals its own calm, intense, and potent presence. For such is the true nature of the vital being, pranayama purusha. It is a projection of the divine purusha into life, tranquil, strong, luminous, many-energied, obedient to the divine will, egoless, yet, or rather, therefore, capable of all action, achievement, highest or largest enterprise. The true life force, too, reveals itself as no longer this troubled, harassed, divided, striving surface energy, but a great and radiant divine power full of peace and strength and bliss. A wide-wayed angel of life with its wings of might enfolding the universe. Wow.
And yet, this transformation into a large strength and equality is insufficient. For if it opens to us the instrumentation of a divine life, it does not provide its government and initiative. It is here that the presence of the released psychic being intervenes. It does not give the supreme government and direction, for that is not its function. But it supplies during the transition from ignorance to a divine knowledge, a progressive guidance for the inner and outer life and action. It indicates at each moment the method, the way, the steps that will lead to that fulfilled spiritual condition in which a supreme dynamic initiative will be always directing the activities of a divinized life force. I must go through this again because I don't get it, if you allow. And yet, this transformation into a large strength and equality is insufficient. For if it opens to us the instrumentation of a divine life, it does not provide its government and initiative. It is here that the presence of the released psychic being intervenes. It does not give the supreme government and direction, for that it is not its function. but it supplies during the transition from ignorance to a divine knowledge a progressive guidance for the inner and outer life and action. It indicates at each moment the method, the way, the steps that will lead to the fulfilled spiritual condition in which the supreme dynamic initiative will be always there directing the activities of a divinized life force. The light it sheds illuminates the other parts of the nature which for want of any better guidance than their own confused and groping powers have been wandering in the rounds of the ignorance. It gives to mind the intrinsic feeling of the thoughts and perceptions, to life the infallible sense of the movements that are misled or misleading and those that are well inspired. Something like quiet oracle from within discloses the causes of our stumbling, warns in time against their repetition, extracts from experience and intuition the law, not rigid but plastic, of a just direction of our acts, a right stepping, an accurate impulse. A will is created that becomes more in consonance with evolving truths rather than with the circling and dilatory mazes of a seeking error. A determined orientation towards the greater light to be a soul instinct, a psychic tact, an insight into the true substance, motion, and intention of things, coming always nearer and nearer to a spiritual vision, to a knowledge by inner contact, inner sight, and even identity, begin to replace the superficial keenness of mental judgment and the eager graspings of the life force. The works of light write themselves, escape from confusion, substitute for the artificial or legal order imposed by the intellect and for the arbitrary rule of desire, the guidance of the soul's inner insight. Enter into the profound path of the spirit. Above all, the psychic being imposes on life the law of the sacrifice of all its works as an offering to the divine and the eternal. Life becomes a call to that which is beyond life. Its every smallest act enlarges the sense of the infinite.
As an inner equality increases, and with it, the sense of the true vital being waiting for the greater direction it has to serve, as the psychic call too increases in all the members of our nature, that to which the call is addressed begins to reveal itself, descends to take possession of the life and its energies, and fills them with the height, intimacy, vastness of its presence and its purpose. In many, if not most, it manifests something of itself even before the equality and the open psychic urge or guidance are there. A call of the veiled psychic element, oppressed by the mass of the outer ignorance and crying for deliverance, a stress of eager meditation and seeking for knowledge, a longing of the heart, a passionate will ignorant, yet but sincere, may break the lid that shuts off that higher from this lower nature and open the floodgates. A little of the divine person may reveal itself, or some light, power, bliss, love out of the infinite. This may be a momentary revelation, a flash, or a brief-lived gleam that soon withdraws and awaits for the preparation of the nature. But also, it may repeat itself, grow, endure. A long and large and comprehensive working will then have begun. Sometimes luminous or intense, sometimes slow and obscure. A divine power comes in front at times and leads and compels or instructs and enlightens. At others, it withdraws into the background and seems to leave the being to its own resources. All that is ignorant, obscure, perverted, or simply imperfect and inferior in the being is raised up, perhaps brought to its acme, dealt with, corrected, exhausted, shown its own disastrous results, compelled to call for its own secession or transformation, or expelled as worthless or incorrigible from the nature. This cannot be a smooth and even process. Alterations there are of day and night, illumination and darkness, calm and construction, or battle and upheaval, the presence of the growing divine consciousness and its absence, heights of hope and abysses of despair, the clasp of the beloved and the anguish of its absence, the overwhelming invasion, the compelling deceit, the fierce opposition, the disabling mockery of hostile powers, or the help and comfort and communion of the gods and the divine messengers. A great and long revolution and churning of the ocean of life with strong emergences of its nectar and its poison is enforced till all is ready and the increasing descent finds a being and nature prepared and conditioned for its complete rule and its all-encompassing presence. But if the equality and the psychic light and will are already there, then this process, though it cannot be dispensed with, can still be much lightened and facilitated. It will be rid of its worst dangers. An inner calm, happiness, confidence will support the steps through all the difficulties and trials of the transformation. And the growing force, profiting by the full ascent for the nature, will rapidly diminish and eliminate the power of the opposing forces. A sure guidance and protection will be present throughout, sometimes standing in front, sometimes working behind the veil. And the power of the end will be already there, even in the beginning and in the long middle stages of the great endeavor. For at all times, the seeker will be aware of the divine guide and protector or the working of the supreme mother force. He will know that all is done for the best, the progress assured, the victory inevitable. In either case, the process is the same and unavoidable, a taking up of the whole nature, of the whole life, of the internal and of the external, to reveal and handle and transform its forces and their movements under the pressure of a diviner life from above, until all here has been possessed by greater spiritual powers and made an instrumentation of a spiritual action and a divine purpose.
In this process, and at an early stage of it, it becomes evident that what we know of ourselves, our present conscious existence, is only a representative formation, a superficial activity, a changing external result of a vast mass of concealed existence. Our visible life and the actions of that life are no more than a series of significant expressions. But that which it tries to express is not on the surface. Our existence is something much larger than this apparent frontal being, which we suppose ourselves to be, and which we offer the world around us. This frontal and external being is a confused amalgam of mind formations, life movements, physical functions of which even an exhaustive analysis into its component parts and machinery fails to reveal the whole secret. It is only when we go behind, below, above, into the hidden stretches of our being that we can know it. The most thorough and acute surface scrutiny and manipulation cannot give us the true understanding or the completely effective control of our life, its purposes, its activities. That inability indeed is the cause of the failure of reason, morality, and every other surface action to control and deliver and perfect the life of the human race. For below even our most obscure physical consciousness is a subconscious being in which, as in a covering and supporting soil, are all manner of hidden seeds that sprout up unaccountably to us on our surface, and into which we are constantly throwing fresh seeds that prolong our past and will influence our future. A subconscious being, obscure, small in its motions, capriciously and almost fantastically subrational, but of an immense potency for the earth life. Again, behind our mind, our life, our conscious physical, there is a larger subliminal consciousness. There are inner mental, inner vital, inner more subtle physical reaches supported by an inmost psychic existence, which is the animating soul of all the rest. And in these hidden reaches, too, lie a mass of numerous pre-existent personalities which supply the material, the motive forces, the impulsions of our developing surface existence. For in each one of us here, there may be one central person, but also a multitude of subordinate personalities created by the past history of its manifestation or by expressions of it on those inner planes which support its present play in this external material cosmos. And while on our surface we are cut off from all around us except through an exterior mind and sense contact, which delivers but little of us to our world or of our world to us, in these inner reaches, the barrier between us and the rest of existence is thin and easily broken. There we can feel at once, not merely infer from their results, but feel directly, the action of the secret world forces, mind forces, life forces, subtle physical forces that constitute universal and individual existence. We shall even be able, if we will but train ourselves to it, to lay our hands on these world forces that throw themselves on us or surround us, and more to control or at least strongly modify their action on us and others, their formations, their very movements. Yet again, above our human mind are still greater reaches, superconscient to it, and from there secretly descend influences, powers, touches, which are the original determinants of things here, and if they were called down in their fullness, could altogether alter the whole make and economy of life in the material universe. It is all this latent experience and knowledge that the divine force working upon us by our opening to it in the integral yoga progressively reveals to us, uses and works out the consequences as means and steps towards a transformation of our whole being and nature. Our life is thenceforth no longer a little rolling wave on the surface, but interpenetrant, if not coincident, with the cosmic life. Our spirit, our self, rises not only into an inner identity with some wide cosmic self, but into some contact with that which is beyond, though aware of, and dominant over the action of the universe.
It is thus by an integralization of our divided being that the divine Shakti in the yoga will proceed to its object. For liberation, perfection, mastery are dependent on this integralization. since the little wave on the surface cannot control its own movement, much less have any true control over the vast life around it. The Shakti, the power of the infinite and the eternal, descends within us, works, breaks up our present psychological formations, shatters every wall, widens, liberates, presents us with always newer and greater powers of vision, ideation, perception, and newer and greater life motives, enlarges and new models increasingly the soul and its instruments, confronts us with every imperfection in order to convict and destroy it, opens to a greater perfection, does in a brief period the work of many lives or ages, so that new births and new vistas open constantly within us. Expansive in her action, she frees the consciousness from confinement in the body. It can go out in trance or sleep or even waking and enter into worlds or other regions of this world and act there or carry back its experience. It spreads out, feeling the body only as a small part of itself, and begins to contain what before contained it. It achieves the cosmic consciousness and extends itself to be commensurate with the universe. It begins to know inwardly and directly, and not merely by external observation and contact, the forces at play in the world, feels their movement, distinguishes their functioning, and can operate immediately upon them as a scientist operates upon physical forces, accept their action and results in our mind, life, body, or reject them or modify, change, reshape, create immense new powers and movements in place of the old small functionings of the nature. We begin to perceive the workings of the forces of universal mind and to know how our thoughts are created by that working, separate from within the truth and falsehood of our perceptions, enlarge, separate from within the truth and falsehood of our perceptions, enlarge their field, extend and illumine their significance, become master of our own mind and action, and capable and active to shape the movements of mind in the world around us. We begin to perceive the flow and surge of the universal life forces, detect the origin and law of our feelings, emotions, sensations, passions, are free to accept, reject, new create, rise to higher planes of life power. We begin to perceive, too, the key to the enigma of matter, follow the interplay of mind and life and consciousness upon it, discover more and more its instrumental and resultant function, and detect ultimately the last secret of matter as a form, not merely of energy, but of involved and arrested or instably fixed and restricted consciousness. And begin to see, too, the possibility of its liberation and plasticity of response to higher powers, its possibilities for the conscious and no longer the more than half inconscient incarnation and self-expression of the spirit. All this and more becomes more and more possible as the working of the divine Shakti increases in us and, against much resistance or labor, to respond of our obscure consciousness through much struggle and movement of progress and regression and renewed progress necessitated by the work of intensive transformation of a half inconscient into a conscious substance, moves to a greater purity, truth, height, range. All depends on the psychic awakening in us, the completeness of our response to her, and our growing surrender.
But all this can only constitute a greater inner life with a greater possibility of the outer action, and it is a transitional achievement. The full transformation can come only by the ascent of the sacrifice to its farthest heights and its action upon life. With the power and light and beatitude of the divine supermental gnosis. For then alone, all the forces that are divided and express themselves imperfectly in life and its works are raised to their original unity, harmony, single truth, authentic absoluteness, and entire significance. Their knowledge and will are one. Love and force, a single movement. The opposites that afflict us here are resolved into their reconciled unity. Good develops its absolute and evil, divesting itself of its error, returns to the good that was behind it. Sin and virtue vanish in a divine purity and an infallible truth movement. The dubious evanescence of pleasure disappears in a bliss that is the play of an eternal and happy spiritual certitude. And pain in perishing discovers the touch of an Ananda which was betrayed by some dark perversion and incapacity of the will of the inconscient to receive it. These things to the mind and imagination or a mystery become evident and capable of experience as the consciousness rises out of limited embodied matter mind to the freedom and fullness of the higher and higher ranges of the super intelligence. But they can become entirely true and normal only when the supramental becomes the law of the nature. It is therefore on the accomplishment of this ascent and on the possibility of a full dynamism from these highest levels descending into earth consciousness that is dependent the justification of life, its salvation, its transformation into divine life in a transfigured terrestrial nature. This section become more and more powerful, I think. But yeah, I suggest we stop here. We have made again, and I suppose every one of us, an overload of power, life, information.
Although we only have 3 pages to go to finish the chapter.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. Okay, I didn't realize that you can finish. Yeah, I don't know. What do you say, Andrea? Is it okay? What's the first? You, John Robert?
I'm suggesting going ahead right now and not stopping here.
Yeah, okay. So you are.
The nature of the integral yoga so conceived, so conditioned, progressing by these spiritual means, turning upon this integral transformation of the nature, determines of itself its answer to the question of the ordinary activities of life and their place in the yoga.
There is not and cannot be here any ascetic or contemplative or mystic abandonment of works and life together, any gospel of an absorbed meditation and inactivity, any cutting away or condemnation of the life force and its activities, any rejection of the manifestation of the earth nature. It may be necessary for the seeker at any period to withdraw into himself, to remain plunged in his inner being, to shut out from him the noise and turmoil of the life of the ignorance until a certain inner change has been accomplished, or something achieved without which a further effective action on life has become difficult or impossible. But this can only be a period or an episode, a temporary necessity, or a preparatory spiritual maneuver. It cannot be the rule of his yoga or its principle.
Splitting up of the activities of human existence on a religious or an ethical basis, or both together, a restriction to the works of worship only, or to the works of philanthropy and beneficence only, would be contrary to the spirit of the integral yoga. Any merely mental rule or merely mental acceptance or repudiation is alien to the purpose and method of its discipline. All must be taken to a spiritual height and placed upon a spiritual basis. The presence of an inner spiritual change and an outer transformation must be enforced upon the whole of life, not merely on a part of life. All must be accepted that is helpful towards this change, or admits it. All must be rejected that is incapable or inept or refuses to submit itself to the transforming movement. There must be no attachment to any form of things or of life, any object, any activity. All must be renounced if need be. All must be admitted that the divine chooses as its material for the divine life. But what accepts or rejects must be neither mind, nor open or camouflaged vital will of desire, nor ethical sense, but the insistence of the psychic being, the command of the divine guide of the yoga, the vision of the higher self or spirit, the illumined guidance of the master. The way of the spirit is not a mental way. A mental rule or mental consciousness cannot be its determinant or its leader.
Equally, a combination or a compromise between two orders of consciousness, the spiritual and the mental, or the spiritual and the vital, or a mere sublimation from within of life, outwardly unchanged, cannot be the law or the aim of the yoga. All life must be taken up, but all life must be transformed. All must become a part, a form, an adequate expression of the spiritual being in the supramental nature. This is a height and crowning movement of the spiritual evolution in the material world, and as a change from a vital animal to mental man made life another thing altogether in basic consciousness, scope, significance, so this change from the materialized mental being to the spiritual and supramental being, using but not dominated by matter, must take up life and make it another thing altogether than the flawed, imperfect, limited human, quite other in its basic consciousness, scope, significance. All forms of life activity that cannot bear the change must disappear. All that can bear it will survive and enter into the kingdom of the spirit. The divine force is at work and will choose at each moment what has to be done or has not to be done, what has to be momentarily or permanently taken up, momentarily or permanently abandoned. For provided we do not substitute for that our desire or our ego, and to that end the soul must be always awake, always on guard, alive to the divine guidance, resistant to the undivine misleading from within or without us, that force is sufficient and alone, competent, and she will lead us to the fulfillment along ways and by means too large and too inward, too complex for the mind to follow, much less to dictate. It is an arduous and difficult and dangerous way, but there is none other.
Two rules alone there are that will diminish the difficulty and obviate the danger. One must reject all that comes from the ego, from vital desire, from the mere mind and its presumptuous reasoning incompetence, all that ministers to these agents of the ignorance. One must learn to hear and follow the voice of the inmost soul, the direction of the guru, the command of the master, the working of the divine mother. Whoever clings to the desires and weaknesses of the flesh, the cravings and passions of the vital in its turbulent ignorance, the dictates of his personal mind, unsilenced and unillumined by a greater knowledge, cannot find the true inner law and is heaping obstacles in the way of the divine fulfillment. Whoever is able to detect and renounce those obscuring agencies and to discern and follow the true guide within and without will discover the spiritual law and reach the goal of the yoga. A radical and total change of consciousness is not only the whole meaning, but in an increasing force and by progressive stages, the whole method of the integral yoga. Well, we've got our task set up for us, don't we?
So we have ended chapter 6, and well, I suppose there are a lot of things maybe we can discuss, but it's a bit late now. Or if someone wants to make some comment, question.
I really kind of like how in the last paragraph, it becomes a little more simple than the many, 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 many words Sri Aurobindo was able to use to describe what he means. One must reject all that comes from the ego, and one must learn to hear and follow the voice of the inmost soul.
I've been reading Joy Harjo's memoir, her autobiography. It's called Conscious Brave. Joy Harjo, as some of you may know, is the poet laureate of the United States, and she's from an indigenous tribe called the Creek that live now in Oklahoma because they were driven out of their home territory. In the American South, Southeast, on the Trail of Tears years ago. So she's the first Native poet laureate of the United States. And in her biography, she talks about the knowing. She uses that word over and over again as the inner guidance. And she describes how sometimes she follows it and sometimes she doesn't, and what the consequences of that are. Those movements are. And since she's a poet, she's a very good writer.
So I heard you say a word that ended with knowing, but I didn't really get the full word.
She calls guidance, what Sri Aurobindo's talked about here is the guidance of the psychic being and the guidance of the inmost soul. She calls it the knowing. The knowing.
The only reflection I had on reading this was that, I think it's a clearly laid out process. And something that we all have some familiarity with, the stages. maybe not all the way, but some of the elements at the earlier parts of the process. But this thing about lack of desire and sort of equal things. So it's just that I notice if I go back over my past, that one can enter into a state where things all seem equal, but that arises out of trauma and dissociation rather than engagement. And so it's something that I notice now is that I have some of this sense of the equality of things, but I check myself to make sure that it's not the result of dissociation, but the result of, you know, a more general engagement, a working through of some of the things that led to dissociation. Because at an earlier stage of my life, things were disconnected from each other and all felt equal, but it had nothing to do with being healthy. Or it had to do with the process of getting towards being healthy, but it wasn't itself a sign of health. So I just think that one has to be aware that there are different, you know. So I mean, when he says one must learn to hear and follow the voice of the inmost soul, clearly that he's not talking about that kind of dissociation, but you know, there is, one can fool oneself sometimes about these things.
Yeah, nice.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was there. Go ahead. There, did you want to say something? Okay. Now I don't find the passage, but he did. There was a paragraph, a piece of a paragraph where he explains the difference here somewhere, where he was speaking that we should not misinterpret what he's saying by an inert and passive detachment, where everything, it's indifferent in the negative sense. So there's a distinction between this spiritual detachment and this passive detachment. And because one can experience this negative when you experience frustration and dissatisfaction, and then say everything should go to hell.
Yes, where I experienced most strongly was in a period where I rejected my own anger. It was in the period following the death of my wife. And I went through this period where I was angry towards her, but I refused to accept that I was angry towards her because, you know, it didn't feel right. And the result of that was this sense of complete dissociation from life. Yeah. I felt that I had no connections. I was like a person looking at myself, looking at life. I wasn't in it. I was looking at myself in it. And it was only when I accepted my anger and reconnected with it that I re-entered the life.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. That was, I think it can be fairly deep, these kinds of things, but.
Oh, yes. In fact, you say dissociation from life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was an experience of dissociation.
Yeah. That's exactly what he does not mean here. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was, just maybe a concluding remark, I was much more, sometimes there are little insignificant, apparently insignificant phrases, sentences that suddenly struck me. When he says, for example, the sentence is so long that means that force is sufficient and alone, so the Shakti, competent, and she will lead us to the fulfillment along ways and by means too large, too inward, too complex for mind, for the mind, too complex for the mind to follow, much less to dictate. It is a perfect description of part of our society, I would say. It is becoming more complex and complex and complex. Things are also here using the computer, the operative system becomes more efficient. You have more functionalities, but sometimes I think it's all so complicated. Why the life, my life at least, well, it took a bit of decades now, but 30, 40 years ago was much more simple, not psychologically, but technically. Yeah? Psychologically not, maybe even worse, but technically, everything is becoming so complex. And we live now in this fantasy. I don't know if you have noticed that this is coming up again, that with technology, with some sort of super technology, super artificial intelligence, we will control everything in our society, which is becoming so complex, will be governed by machines and things like that. No, it will not work because it's too complex for the mind to follow. I just have to think about the German bureaucracy or the Italian bureaucracy. Even worse. It's such a level of complexity. And we believe that making this more and more complex will give us more control. Whereas exactly the opposite is happening because dishonest persons are trying to, well, how do you say? The cheat. No, this dishonesty finds its way through this bureaucratic quagmire, complex quagmire. And we live now in this hyper-mentalized society which believes that it is will be able to dominate this complexity and even dictate its, and I think we will go, we are going to the collapse of this. We will see this in the next years coming, yet next decades, because I see this more and more. But this is more a technical aspect, not a spiritual, but it makes part of our society. And he's saying mind will not be able to control all. And there are out there very intelligent persons, professors, university professors, which are saying us, we must rediscover the reason of the enlightenment and rationality, which is in a certain sense, there is also some truth in that. But that alone will not work, I think. We will have to find this inner master, this direction of the guru, command of the master, of the divine mother. Only then we will be able to fathom this complexity. I see this in my personal life, so I'm just making a parallel with the society. Maybe it's more comprehensible. Okay. Closing remark from my side.
I worked in a software company some years back, and the software that was being created was complex. And it was over a million lines of code. And the computer, programmers themselves admitted that nobody, there was no one person who understood it. And that's been some years back.
You can point to, and I understand and I agree with you about this sort of argument about the AI and controlling all this and all the rest of it. But there are other things that have emerged at the same time. So the simpler lives that we had were also very homogeneous lives. And we no longer live homogeneous lives. We are surrounded by influences from other cultures, other ways of life. The whole awareness of the different oppressions, the different, has exploded our cultural lives so into complexity, but the interesting kind of complexity, right? The kind that you can't get at by mental means. So while there are tendencies towards increasing mentalization, there are also counter tendencies towards increasing complexity on other levels. The ecological movement also, and the effort to grapple with the sustainability issues for the planet, also take us out of the pure mentalizations, although there is a mentalization movement within it, but there are other things going on there. So I'm not quite so pessimistic about this.
Yeah, I totally agree that there is also, I highlighted only one side of the coin. But it is coming up. It is a reaction, yes. I was also thinking at this figure of the John Robert, in fact, mentioned it, that the indigenous people, the simple life of the indigenous people, their contact with nature, this perception, this inner perception of Mother Nature. And this is something that comes not from the mind, is something that has also its spiritual component. And we are learning, the Western society, the technological, the mentalized Western society, but also now the Asian society, every society, is discovering that they have also a treasure to offer to the world. And that's the simplicity connected also to a spiritual vision of nature and things. Yeah. And people are now recognizing that this indigenous culture is important for the survival of the world, in a sense. And which is based also in simplicity. Or a state of consciousness where complexity becomes simple. Because I think at the higher levels of consciousness, what at our mental level seems extremely complex, at a higher level of consciousness becomes self-evident. Almost.
Would you like a bell for a final meditation for 2 minutes before we leave? I have another meeting at 45 minutes, so I need to finish up soon. So.
Good to be with you, along with Sri Aurobindo.
Yes, good company.
Another very inspiring session.
Yes.
Yeah.
Longer than usual, but also very inspiring. Thank you. Thank you to all.
Thank you too. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Namaste.
Lovely. See you next time. Bye-bye.